It's Friday, and that means another edition of the Zogby Report, real and unscripted. As you know already, and for the newcomers, I'll let you know. This is where I, John, and my son, Jeremy, look at some news of the week and then try to share different and broader perspectives on how we see things developing and what we think they mean. And so we have dealt with a wide variety of issues over the last, you know what, year and a half now. So we're seasoned veterans at this. Jer, how are you doing this week?
Doing very well. How about you?
Good, thanks. I should know. I just saw you. So I already knew you were doing well, but that was for public consumption. All right, so I've got three topics that I literally just came up with, as you can see. And I'm going to let you know what they are. Number one, why can't we get an infrastructure bill passed in Congress? It is getting into the latter part of June. Secondly, led by former President Trump's personal physician, who is now in Congress, there is now movement among GOP members of Congress that Joe Biden take a cognitive test. I want to talk about that a little bit. And then thirdly, Saturday is Juneteenth. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that and critical race theory and so on. So a full agenda. So let's start with infrastructure. Here's what I don't understand. The president's overall approval rating is 53%, which as things go for this century is very good. Rarely have presidents, and that includes Bush, Obama, and Trump, had numbers consistently, approval numbers in the 50s. When we take apart each of the element of the president's proposed infrastructure bill, the support is anywhere from 75%, you know, allotting money to traditional roads and bridges, to 69% for bandwidth and internet expansion, and so on. And then into the 60s and 50s, when it comes to parental leave and childcare, and what the president talks about is kinds of programs that free up middle class workers, and at the same time provide some relief for them so they can become more productive. If that's the case, why can't we get an infrastructure bill? I know that there are legitimate arguments that Republicans make about spending. The president proposes paying for a good bit of this by increasing taxes, mainly on high income workers, the high income earners, I should say. The Republicans, led by Senator McConnell, say that there will be no tax increases for anyone. The president says we need this wide package. We're talking about more than just roads and bridges. We're talking about reviving this economy, priming the pump, making workers happier and more productive. Republicans say we just want to talk about hard infrastructure alone, and we don't want to bust the budget, although arguably I think both sides would agree that the budget is pretty well busted. Why can't we get an infrastructure bill? To me, I'm baffled by it.
Well, I think the easy answer is we are so divided in terms of partisan and ideology that whoever's in power, just by the nature of that division and these two antagonistic parties, whoever's sitting in the presidency has an agenda, whether it's domestic or foreign. The other side is just going to disagree with it because it's not their agenda. I mean, we've seen that for quite a long time now, that very harsh and potent division. Clearly, it goes back a while, but in terms of the great intensity, it's been with us since the turn of the millennium, and it's only getting worse. So I think that's really the easy answer.
So the hard answer is our democracy teetering on the brink? I mean, can you have a democracy where, I mean, look, it's one thing, one side gets elected, the other side is opposition. The British use the term loyal opposition. And if you've ever watched British Parliament, or for that matter, any parliament, you know, the British will boo and hiss. The Japanese and the Hong Kong and Taiwan parliaments will actually get into fisticuffs with each other. But ultimately, something happens. We're in a situation where ultimately, really very little happens that is momentous. But can you run a democracy if one side, and I'm talking about the Democrats on the flip side, you know, when they didn't have the presidency, when can you have a democracy where you don't recognize the legitimacy that the winner won? And secondly, you block pretty much everything that's of any importance. I mean, what is Mitch McConnell's legacy going to be, his tombstone? He said no more times than anybody else. Is that a legacy?
I mean, I wouldn't, I know you're not just blaming it on Mitch McConnell. I just know that's the most immediate example, but I mean, I often think about the study that was conducted back in 2014 among scholars at Princeton who said that we have ceased to have a democracy. We effectively have an oligarchy. I can't remember who, I think they were political scientists, but that's pretty amazing coming from Princeton. If you're interested, just try and Google Princeton, maybe Princeton scholars and oligarchy, study in oligarchy, and it should emerge. But I mean, effectively, we don't have a system that is of the people, for the people, and by the people. We have a system where special interest rules. And special interest is not uniform. Special interest is very divided. And I think that that's the root of the problem, that we have special interests with so much power, and at the same time, they're divided, and then we get thrown into the mix. And then also, we don't really have, I mean, how can you really have a functioning democracy when it's a duopoly, right? Mm-hmm. For how long have we had two-party domination? And the rules are written such, not only at the federal level, but at the state level as well, that it is very difficult for an independent or third party to arrive on the scene. The rules are written to exclude that. And so, I mean, it just goes back to that Princeton study that I would then take it to the next step and say that this duopoly that we have, this control of the two-party system has enabled an oligarchy.
So, I have other topics that I want to go over, but here's a question about third parties. And I do believe there will be one. In fact, to be brutally honest with you, I think there'll be a second party. I think the Republican Party will be out of existence. That's a topic for another day. But everything you say about the duopoly, you know, you and I have talked about this. We're in agreement. But we elect an independent, Andrew Yang becomes president of the United States. I don't think under any circumstances we think of Andrew Yang, unless I'm missing something, as somebody who's part of the elite. Yes, he's wealthy, but I don't think that he travels in the circles, belongs to the clubs, you know, goes to Bilderberg, does all the sorts of things that conspiratorialists would say. But so Andrew Yang becomes president of the United States. He's got to pick cabinets and deputy secretaries and pick an administration and find people who know what they're doing and know how to work their way through the system. So what does he do? Does he appoint Joe the produce man to be Secretary of Agriculture? Because, well, this guy knows fruits and vegetables and has dealt with farmers. Or does he pick, you know, some elite figure who has been in the agriculture department, has
like
worked
Sonny
for
Purdue, right?
What's that?
Like Sonny Purdue.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so I mean, how does a third party function then?
Well,
how do you pick good people? Well, you gotta have good people.
I alluded to this in maybe three podcasts ago. I said that I have exited the political spectrum, right? I gave the most extreme example. I said, you look at our political spectrum and it's a false dichotomy. You go all the way to the left and you have communism. You go all the way to the right and you have fascism. What is the real difference between those two ideologies? Can you really tell me that there is a great difference between Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, other than the fact that Joseph Stalin actually killed about 10 to 15 million more people than the 6 million people Hitler slaughtered? Actually, that's only counting the Jews. That's not counting his invasion of Russia. So actually, maybe they're more on par. Maybe the most substantive difference between fascism and communism is that under communism, there was outright ownership of the means of production by the state, whereas in a fascist economy, it had to be the corporations were able to maintain their private ownership, but they had to be completely in lockstep and in concert with the state. These are very minimal differences. It's basically two totalitarian regimes on the opposite ends of the spectrum that give this a appearance of being opposite of each other? No.
So how does that connect with what we're talking about here in U.S. democracy?
Because I explained how on the extreme ends, it's a false dichotomy. As you go closer to the center and you get to the left and the right in the United States, the same phenomenon happens. There's this very thin appearance, this very, I want to say, shallow appearance that there's any meaningful difference between the left and the right. Both the left and the right, whoever's in power, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, the state becomes larger, the state becomes more intrusive. You still have wars, you still have economic downturns, and you still have a dwindling middle class. Yes, they will use different iconography. Yes, they will target different, you know, subgroups and appeal to them in different ways. But at the end of the day, the state always grows. The American people in general lose more of their freedoms, and the middle class dies as wars continue. So it is the left-right political ideology, as it is taught, is a false system. If we shifted our ideological understanding of the political spectrum to really the real divide is top-down versus grassroots, you would have more regional and more localized rule. And I think there is the answer to your question that, yeah, sure, in a third party, you don't want a successful regional level manufacturer to direct the nation's policies, but you might want him or her to direct the region's policies. So by nature, the talk of a third party can't be federalized. It has to be more regionalized and localized. And I think that's the way that we get our democracy back, is moving the issue away from centralization, which hasn't really brought us any progress over 100 years. I mean, like I said, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, the middle class dies. We need a complete rehaul of our understanding of not only party, but ideology and policy.
Okay. Should Joe Biden take a cognitive test to prove that he is still with us?
I'm doing a Biden gaffe right now. They tried that with Trump, right? It all comes down to who you love and who you hate. If you hate Trump,
exactly,
you're going to think he's a narcissist and you're going to think he's off the rocker. And if you hate Biden, you're going to think he's crazy. Do I think Trump is a narcissist? Absolutely. Look at the way he talks. Do I think Biden has some issues? I think the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you know, I've never seen a president who almost talks down on himself and say, oh, why did I say that? And has 5 to 7 second gaffes in between a question. I've never seen that. There are people who are 90 years old who don't do that. So I'm objectively looking at it, and it looks to be kind of like a Reagan phenomenon. There does kind of appear to be a blank stare in his eyes, but I don't think a cognitive test is really, if people are going to believe whatever they want to believe. You have to.
The entire call for the cognitive test to be, at the very least, offensive, and incredibly partisan, and a symbol of just how low the other side has come. Now, I'm saying this from a vantage point. March 1st, 1985, I met Ronald Reagan in the White House, spent about 30 minutes with him, with a small group. There were about 8 of us. And we walked out of that room absolutely convinced that this man, that our president, was gone. There is no other conclusion one could draw. There were 8 of us, like I said, half of which were strong supporters of Reagan, the other half of which were Democrats. But there wasn't a question in anybody's mind that this man was, at least at early onset, at that point in time. And yet, still had the facility about him as a professional actor to play the part in public, even to the point where his look and his physical mannerisms were such that he was robust and straight and so on. He was also highly scripted. But when he wasn't scripted, there were problems. But there were no calls at that point in time for cognitive tests. There was a sense of respect. The man had been reelected by a huge landslide, his second landslide. And, you know, in the final analysis, there was also a sense, even from the most liberal Democrats, that he has surrounded himself by competent people, which is what presidents do. I mean, presidents don't load the dishwasher. You know, presidents don't, handle the minutest of details. You appoint and surround yourself by competent people, which Joe Biden has done. But this whole notion of the President Biden has lost it is a fake issue, and it's a mean-spirited issue. And I know I'm coming off a bit more partisan than I normally do, but that's because I'm coming off a bit more partisan than I normally do. I think it's offensive.
I would just ask the question, why didn't you apply or why don't you apply the same thing to when the Democrats were in lockstep unison calling for the same thing for Trump? I mean, it just proves my point that whoever you love and whoever you hate, it really just comes down to that. If you hated Trump, he was nuts. And if he was nuts,
there were differences. Seriously, there were differences. First of all, Trump built his presidency around name calling and viscerally going after what he perceived to be and called out the weakest points of not only his opponents, but also his supporters. Secondly, it's arguable that he appointed the most competent people. And even when he did appoint competent people, he denigrated them publicly and privately. And then you saw all during his first term, let alone the last few weeks when it became really unhinged, a lot of these people, resigning, marching out. So it was a different style. He he took on the challenge to demean and denigrate people, and in turn, he got it back.
And does that mean that you're certifiably insane?
I'd go so far as to say something's wrong, but they handled it through impeachment, and they lost the impeachment for whatever reasons there were. But I don't think that Donald Trump was a victim. I think in many ways he was a perpetrator who got some just desserts.
Well, that's a different angle. I mean, to say whether he got what he deserved or whether that, you know, he was certifiably insane are two different things. He was a demagogue, and that's what demagogues do. But you know, these are two different issues. But as we see here, it really just got, personally, like everybody knows who listens to this podcast, that I reject both parties, and I haven't been in support of a president in a very long time. I don't know that I ever really did support a president.
So we have a little bit of time here, and it's relevant because of the President and Congress passing and signing just today and tomorrow. So that would be June 19th is Juneteenth, is now a federal holiday. Critics, there are 14 in the House of Representatives that voted against making it a federal holiday. They called it divisive and singling out one group of people at the expense of unity in the nation. I totally disagree with that sentiment. If there's such a thing as 101%, then that's where I stand on that sentiment. Is Juneteenth a legitimate federal holiday, or is it something that can produce more discord and disunity?
I mean, what you said, 14 members of Congress opposed it.
Yeah,
I mean that's a, so. I mean, you had well over 500 who supported it.
Yes.
I mean that the headline right there is the immense unity over. Over our nation, when you watch the corporate media, I mean, you would think that we're the most racist nation in the history of the world. And here members of Congress get together and almost in what, 95-96%, they agree on something.
That's got to be. Yeah,
I think that's amazing. I think that's a wonderful thing to celebrate.
And I think that's a good point. I think that's a very good point.
And absolutely. I mean, this is something from the standpoint of the Black culture that is akin to the 4th of July. Why not? Right. Why not have that as a holiday? They've been selling it. Celebrating it since 1865. I think that there's a different issue that I would highlight that's not directly attached to Juneteenth, but because I'm heavily anti-war, I think that another element that should be a part of Juneteenth, not only in the celebration of the ending of the suffering, but is also remembering that the Civil War was a tragedy in terms of the loss of human life, that 700,000 Americans perished. And here was a war that, you know, it's an amazing historical fact that the United States is the only Western nation that fought a war over ending slavery, whereas every other Western nation, the institution just died out. And we know from history, the South was an old dying man. They were already on the deathbed. They were, you know, they were about to be lights out within a generation. And so I think if we could infuse a little bit of an anti-war sentiment to that federal holiday, and say that this is a wonderful thing that we conquered slavery, but let's also remember that it's a really terrible, tragic thing that we were the only country in the Western world that actually had to lose 700,000 people over it.
So I'm just gonna amend what you said. Whereas the economic system may very well of slavery may very well have been dead as a labor system and as a generator of a regional economy. The fact of the matter is that the culture that was developed, the superstructure is what sociologists would say, but the infrastructure around slavery that supported it, most notably racism, was not going to be dead in the next generation or so, and hence the Civil War. But very importantly, the first shot of that of the Civil War and the whatever it was that made the war necessary was launched by the dying economy and civilization, and not by the North and the Unionists. And so that would be my amendment.
I mean, there's definitely a different interpretation of that. First of all, racism, even though Reconstruction only made racism worse in the South, but racism didn't go away in the North. So the North really has no high moral ground in the war. And I'm of the interpretation that the Civil War, even though there were the moralists like Harriet Beecher Stowe and Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass in the North who launched a moral crusade, it really came down to a war of the bankers and by the bankers of the Northeastern elite that really had the interest to destroy the South and remake them in an industrial image of their own so that they could conquer the South. And it was purely an economic war, and it was not a moral war. Lincoln's strategy of the emancipation was psychological warfare. It wasn't the high moral ground because he himself was a white supremacist.
No doubt about that. But my final point only is I don't disagree with a lot of what you said, but what is important is psychological impact. Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation to preserve the Union, to give it not only a new cause to fight for, but to break the back of the Southern economy. It was a military gesture, not a moral gesture. On the other hand, when you read the accounts of slaves themselves, and you learn that when word spread the Emancipation Proclamation had been issued, and that's even with the fine nuance that no slaves were freed in border states, they were freed, quote unquote, in Confederate states over which technically Lincoln had no jurisdiction. Even with that said, the effect was that black slaves went on a general strike and put their tools down and began crisscrossing the South, trying to reunite their families. And in essence, then, what may have been arguably a cynical gesture or a purely military gesture on the part of Lincoln did in fact for many become a moral crusade. That's my final point. You can have the last word if you'd like. It'd be all right if you don't want it.
I made my case pretty strongly, but as always, I mean, this is, you know, whether it's political wars or history wars, people have made up their minds. I just wish that we would, like what you and I do, we would welcome this. And you notice we never hurl insults at each other. We never cut each other off blatantly. What we do is model what really the rest of society should do, is never be threatened by an alternative viewpoint. Welcome it and debate it and let the best idea win. I just do want to say one thing. This was something I wanted to talk about. But I, you know, we can maybe push this off into the week, but top story of the week, of the last couple of weeks, no question about it, is the mounting evidence against Anthony Fauci and his gain of function research. And I don't think that that's, you know, that's not this QAnon Republican, you know, whatever conservative thing. You've got some serious evidence, even from the emails that were, by the way, heavily redacted in the Freedom of Information Act request that BuzzFeed had. But one damning email talks about the fact that of a scientist who wrote to Fauci early on in the pandemic and said, this virus has all of the features of a genetically laboratory developed virus, and that there is a money trail that follows going years back. And the Wall Street Journal has reported on this, of Anthony Fauci funding the Wuhan lab. I don't think that this is something that has to turn into a white man versus Chinese man, America versus China type thing, because clearly the two are connected. The highest level bureaucrat in the United States funding the Wuhan Lab Institute. I'll let the prosecutors of the Nuremberg Trials 2.0 decide that, because they're the professionals, but the evidence is mounting, and that is top story.
And I want to talk, so let's make it a point, barring anything else happening next week, I want to talk about critical race theory as it is becoming a politically charged issue in the 2022 campaign. So let's mark that down, and I'll give you Fauci and you give me critical race theory. Okay. And then say, I want you to end this podcast by saying, I am not calling for a cognitive test for my father. And that would make me very happy.
Never. There's no need for it.
All right, good.
There never was either. Even when you were a radical.
Hey, goodbye, everybody. We'll see you next week.